The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. I'm back from Science Online 2011 in North Carolina. Let me just say, if you're a science communicator, a science journalist, or a scientist who wants to get the word out about your work, there is absolutely no better place to bask in the brilliance and mutually supportive glow of others of your kind than Science Online. If you'd like to figure out if it's your kind of conference, you can browse through the workshops and sessions that were held this year at scienceonline2011.com. On today's episode, I'm very happy to welcome back Dr. Gary Stadtmauer, New York allergist, who will be answering a simply massive amount of audience questions and some of mine. But let's begin with another health issue. I'm here with Michael Cruz, paramedic and co-chair of the Committee for the Advancement of Scientific Skepticism at the Center for Inquiry Canada and an organizer for the 1023 campaign in Canada. Welcome back, Michael.
Thank you. And you get a big prize for getting through that entire introduction with that long title. Thank you so much.
Well, now 1023 is the International Homeopathy Awareness Campaign. So maybe just to give our audience some background, could you explain what homeopathy is?
I'm going to start by saying what homeopathy isn't. Homeopathy is not herbalism, naturopathy, or based on giving actual ingredients. Homeopathy was invented in the late 18th century by a gentleman named Samuel Hahnemann, and he decided that medicine should be used under the rule of the law of similars, which is one of the rules he developed, that like cures like. And the basic principle says that you take a substance at full dosage and you write down all the effects that it has on you. Then if you dilute these medicines to the extent that there's not any original substance left, that they will then cure the symptoms that you originally felt by the original concentration.
Now, what do they say it can do, homeopathy?
Well, what do they say it can't do? They claim to treat a lot of chronic conditions, especially ones that are resistive to modern medicine, fibromyalgia, certain pain conditions, other chronic illnesses that we don't have a lot of good answers for, often drives people to homeopaths as sort of a last resort. They also claim to do things which have much more broader implications for public health, like prophylaxis or prevention of communicable diseases like polio, measles, and whooping cough.
So what does science say about all of this then?
Yeah, this is the current debate. After the CBC Marketplace event or program last weekend, there's been a great furor of homeopaths rising up and saying, but we have science on our side. There are scientific and clinical trials saying that homeopathy works. Unfortunately, they're wrong. A great example of this, or a great compilation of this evidence, is found at the British Parliamentary Committee's on Science and their Evidence Check 2, which occurred last year and reported, I believe, last April, where they did an extensive review of the current research in homeopathy and found that there was actually no evidence to suggest that homeopathy works any better than placebo. It may have an effect, but it is only the placebo effect, where people perceive that they are getting better when, in fact, there is no actual change in the progression of the disease.
Well, now, you mentioned the CBC Marketplace piece. That segment was quite critical of homeopathy. Can you tell us about that?
It was one of the very first mainstream media programs to actually confront homeopathy and its claims. There was several segments. They had some homeopathic medications tested by a lab, and the lab could find no difference, right? They were just water. They also had a fun stunt by CFI, Center for Inquiry Vancouver, where they did a homeopathic overdose. They took a bunch of different medications in very large amounts, and of course nothing happened. There was absolutely no effect. So the CBC Marketplace really shone a spotlight on the paucity of evidence.
So what was the response to that piece from the public?
There was quite a mobilization by the homeopathic community, even before it was aired, to bombard the CBC Marketplace site with comments pro-homeopathy. and to try to derail any kind of negative image that the show might have. Now, in fact, the show did shine a negative light on homeopathy, and we were told by the producers, unofficially, I think, that that CBC Marketplace episode was the highest rated Marketplace ever in the history of the program. So I think there's a general interest. I think that there is a perception that homeopathy is just another form of herbalism, that they're just giving traditional medications that perhaps have indications and perhaps have some evidence behind them, when in fact they're giving out sugar pills and water and calling it medicine.
Well, now this is where 1023 comes in, for the public awareness aspect of this.
Absolutely. Last year, the Merseyside Skeptics out of the UK staged a protest last year in response to Boots Pharmacy, who is a large distributor of homeopathic medications in the UK. Of course, homeopathy is much more mainstream in the United Kingdom. In Britain, they have had several homeopathic hospitals. And so the 1023 campaign was born out of Merseyside's attempt to do an overdose of homeopathic medications to protest Boots' selling of these products. It was very successful. It was more successful than Merseyside Skeptics had ever dreamed. They got a lot of press out of it. So, of course, they're going to do it again. So this year, they decided to take it internationally. And there are many countries participating. Canada was one of the first countries. But the United Kingdom, obviously, Germany, Belgium, France, Australia, the United States were all participating in the 1023 event, which this year is taking place the weekend of February 5th and 6th. In the U.S., of course, it's Super Bowl Sunday on February the 6th, so many Canadian and U.S. events are taking place on the 5th. But the idea is to stage a homeopathic overdose, to tape it, and then the video product from all over the world will be uploaded to the Merseyside Skeptics and be shown at the QED conference, which is a skeptical conference that Merseyside is throwing in the UK on the 6th of February. The idea now is to mobilize sort of the international press and to raise awareness of the absurdity of homeopathy all over the world. So to that end, CFI Canada agreed to sort of be the point person in Canada as far as communications goes. And we've been communicating with several skeptics groups across the country and, of course, CFI branches across the country to organize events that weekend. Many of us are doing it on the 5th. There are a couple of people doing it on the 6th of February. Not only CFI is doing this event, we've got an independent group from Kitchener-Waterloo, led by Steve Toms from Skeptic North fame. We've got the Skeptique du Québec, which I think is very exciting for CFI and skeptics to sort of reach out to our Québécois compatriots. The Association for Science and Reason out of Ontario, and we've got Winnipeg Skeptics on board. I just spoke to them today. So we've got events occurring across Canada from Vancouver, Edmonton, Winnipeg, Toronto, Kitchener-Waterloo, Ottawa, and Montreal at this point.
Now, if anyone wants to hear about what's going on in Australia on 1023, Kylie Sturgis of tokenskeptic.org, her podcast actually has a few interviews coming out this Friday, I believe, with organizers from Australia.
I'm excited by the fact that we're all sort of communicating with each other. Like for many years now, because of turf wars and because we haven't really been in the public spotlight, we've been able to sort of grumble, you know, and be by ourselves. But we're going to have a bigger impact in numbers if we join together and have a unified message. So that, I think, is the exciting part. I'm excited to be talking to skeptics from all over Canada.
Well, how do you respond to the people who do use homeopathy for whatever reason that may feel like they're being made fun of by the 1023 campaign? Or even just that homeopathy use, it isn't bothering you, so why don't you just leave people be?
Yeah, that's the whole what's the harm argument. There's nothing wrong with that in itself. Like, you're only really taking water. And, you know, we have personal health freedom and we can make choices for ourselves. I do believe, and I think this is sort of the general feeling of the skeptical community, if I can indeed speak on their behalf, that making a choice requires information. And it's not a real choice unless it's informed. And when we have homeopaths offering vaccines, calling them vaccines, they're changing their language. After we've called them on them, they're now starting to call them, you know, prophylaxis or prevention for things like the flu. Anti-malarial medications or anti-malarial homeopathic preparations being sold in England, which of course did nothing, and actually people got malaria after using them because they traveled to countries where they thought they were protected from malaria, and they actually got malaria. The people who go to homeopaths, I have nothing, like, I can't blame them. They're looking for answers, and homeopaths are saying, come on in, I've got them all. You know, any rational person has learned to trust medical professionals. And if homeopaths are standing up and saying, I'm a medical professional, people are going to trust them. I have a problem with the homeopaths themselves, and I have a problem with the organizations that that promote and teach homeopathy because they're ignoring the science and they're spreading bad information. I do want to say that I don't think that homeopaths are bad people and are out to get people, like our snake oil salesmen who know their products are fraudulent and they're selling them anyways. I don't think that's true. And I really do believe that the person providing the care in their office and the patients going to them are good people. They want to do best. They're just misled. And it's putting people at risk. If you're promoting not getting vaccines, if you're going to be telling people that they have another choice, they don't have to get their pertussis to prevent whooping cough in their children. They can just bring their children to the homeopath and get a homeopathic prophylaxis. Well, that's dangerous because whooping cough is on the rise, and there are children dying. Or things like measles, which infected 600,000 people in the U.S. a year before the vaccine was introduced. Right? Those kind of things have if carried to a greater extent, will have great threat to public health. And those are the kind of messages we want to tell people. Because I think if people knew that the choices that consumers are making doesn't make them bad people, that it just means they're not informed. I think if they really see that their health could be at risk, then more people will choose not to go to a homeopath and will seek a conventional medicine instead.
So if people do want to get involved with a 1023 event near them, where can they go?
If you want to get involved, the best thing to do is to email us at CASS. I won't say the whole name. CASS is our short form. CASS at CFICanada.ca. That will come to me and to our executive director and my co-chair, Ian Martell, and we'll be able to respond to you and add you to the group or point you to groups in your local area that are actually participating. And really, 2 people, 200 people, anywhere in between, doesn't matter. Videotape it. A public event is better. But if you just want to do it in your basement and videotape it and send it to the QED, to Merseyside, that's great as well. You can also keep informed if you're not participating and just want to keep up on the events by following us on Twitter at CFICASS. Which is our Twitter handle, and then on Facebook, we're at CASS at CFI Canada. Search for that. We're on the Facebook page. We are trying to develop a 1023 blog or something for Canada. That, again, requires somebody to actually know something about web-based things, which I don't do, so we'll have to find someone to do that. But keep open to that. But follow us at on Twitter and at Facebook and email CASS if you have any information or if you want any information or participating, because we'll be glad to help you out.
Good to talk to you again, Michael. Thanks for being here.
You're very welcome, Desiree. Thanks for having me.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes or listen to past episodes. And while you're there, why not add your review? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
I'm talking today with Dr. Gary Stadtmauer. He teaches in the Allergy Fellowship Program at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine and maintains a private practice in Manhattan. When we had Dr. Stadtmauer on the show at the beginning of episode 85 to speak specifically about food allergies, we received far more audience questions than it is remotely possible to get to. So we decided to have him back for a feature interview. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Hello.
So tell us a bit about your practice, first of all. How long have you been an allergist?
I finished my fellowship training in 1996, so that makes 14 years. And in our practice, we see a wide range of allergic disorders. We have a focus on respiratory disorders, sinus disease, and chronic cough, because in some ways we practice medicine like otolaryngologists, because we do endoscopy of the nose, sinus cavities, and larynx, which we find is the proper way to, or the best way to, manage asthma and conditions that can mimic asthma, better diagnose sinus conditions. But of course, we see food allergy and skin disorders, immune problems, drug allergies, and a bunch of other things which people think might be allergic, such as acne and other things which really are not, but people sometimes really need to sit down and speak to an allergist about things. Sometimes it's just their own theories.
Now, you don't just practice. You also work as an educator.
I blog for Medscape, which is the doctor's portal on WebMD. I have a website. It's really for my practice, for my patients, but I also put some educational videos on there. I've put some educational videos on YouTube about stinging insect allergy, latex allergy. You know, I think that one of the best ways for a doctor to stay current is to teach. And, you know, teaching at the Mount Sinai Fellowship Program is certainly a way to do that because they have an active research program. The fellows can help me keep abreast, let's say, of the latest research that some of the food allergy researchers are doing. And I try to teach them a lot of the teach them from my clinical experience. So it works both ways.
There definitely seem to be some pretty common misconceptions about allergies. Is it as bad among doctors who aren't allergy specialists as it is among patients?
You know, it depends on the condition. Sometimes doctors will send me patients who have irritable bowel syndrome and they wonder whether it's a food allergy. And by and large, most patients with irritable bowel don't have food allergies. But and even the testing that we have available to us to diagnose food allergies are really best at detecting immediate sensitivities to food, immediate sensitivity reactions, which manifest with hives, difficulty breathing, perhaps even going into anaphylactic shock. And the skin test that we do gives immediate results. The blood tests are effective, but yield false positive test results. And so very often a doctor will say, sure, I'll test you for allergies, and they run the test, and then in fact they get positive results because there are false positives, and then patients don't know what to do, and then they see us.
We have lay people who listen to the show, but we also have doctors that listen. So maybe let's try and clear some of these things up, starting with the basics. So what exactly are allergies?
Allergies are, that's funny that it's not a tough question, it is, but in fact, let's break it down into different types of adverse reactions first. Irritant responses are not allergic. An irritant response is something just not disagreeing with someone. Let's say food poisoning, a glove that someone wears that is simply irritating to the skin, frequent hand washing can lead to an irritant dermatitis. These are examples of a reaction which has nothing to do with the physiology whatsoever, the physiology or the immunology. Then we could talk about reactions that to some degree involve enzymes or physiology. And that an example of that would be lactose intolerance. An enzyme, lactase, is deficient. It's usually a genetic defect, which has a variable expression. And in that instance, ingesting lactose in the form of milk or cheeses leads to bloating, gas, and diarrhea. That's not an immune response, and the allergy skin test there is negative. Then we can move on to immune responses, which we would consider allergic. And in fact, that can involve a range of responses. Now, when allergists think of allergy, we sometimes are almost too strict in our definition. We think of it as involvement of an allergic antibody. That's IgE. That is the classic allergic response that allergists encounter, and that involves immediate hypersensitivity. That's a bee sting leading to wheezing, hives, difficulty breathing, anaphylaxis. The skin test in those tests is positive, and the blood testing for allergic antibodies may be positive as well. But other allergic responses can can occur without involving an allergic antibody. An example is aspirin allergy. Someone can have hives, difficulty breathing, even anaphylaxis with low blood pressure or a severe asthma attack through a mechanism that mimics allergy and, in fact, involves allergic cells but is not mediated by an allergic antibody. And then you have different types of allergy. You know, there's a type 1 allergy is what I just reviewed, and then there's involving the IgE antibody, and then there is a type 4 allergy, which an example of which would be poison ivy or contact dermatitis. That involves a different arm of the immune system. It's an allergy, but it's not an immediate sensitivity. Have I confused you?
No.
Good.
So maybe let's talk about, actually, I have a question on this topic. Let's go here.
Sure.
Now, this is from Dana Blumrosen. Last night, my wife and I were driving home from a party, and she started feeling itchy around her ankles. Having ruled out flea bites, and as her rash slash itchiness spread to the rest of her body, we started speculating as to whether she was having a mild allergic reaction to the homemade pecan caramel candies and the walnuts in the salad, even though she never had any allergies to nuts as a child. Can the good MD explain the difference between a true dangerous food allergy and a more mild, albeit still very irritating, food sensitivity?
Well, if allergic antibodies are present, IgE, then one could say the potential is there for a more serious allergic response. And so I think the way it works with true immediate sensitivity is that there's always a possibility of somebody developing a more severe reaction, and that has to do with three things. Number one is the general sensitivity. Some people are simply more allergic to something than others. Number two is the degree of allergen to which they're exposed. And number three is to what degree they have other conditions that put them at risk. So if somebody has severe asthma to begin with, it's not going to take a lot of peanut for them to, let's say, if they're peanut allergic, it's not going to take much of an allergen in general, a food allergen, to push them over to even a more severe asthma episode. And the other thing to mention is that there are cofactors that will aggravate an allergic response. So let's take an example of one of the patients I saw a few years ago who had something called oral allergy syndrome. An oral allergy syndrome, which is also known as the fruit pollen syndrome, is a syndrome in which someone is first sensitized to a pollen, most commonly birch pollen, and that's through the nose, through the respiratory tract. And because the pollen antibody, the antibody to birch pollen, also happens to recognize structurally similar proteins in foods, these people very often develop low-grade and local reactivity to peaches, plums, other pitted fruits, sometimes also carrots and celery. So my patient had itching in the mouth when he ate carrots. He would eat one or two carrots. He never quite knew what it was, and he would just stop. Nothing bad happened. Then he decided that he was going to have freshly prepared carrot juice. And this was raw carrots that had been blended. And he drank the whole thing, ignoring whatever itching he had in the mouth. There really wasn't so much. And then he went into anaphylactic shock and nearly died. Why? Dose. That was an example of someone who rapidly ingested a very concentrated form of an allergen. So getting back to this patient's question, this man's question about his wife, I don't know what her prior exposure to nuts was. We don't know that it was walnuts. It's reasonable to think that nuts are a cause. Nuts are a frequent cause of an allergy. I don't know how old this man is. If this man's wife is 80, well, new food allergies don't present usually that late in life. So what are the demographics of this individual? Is this individual allergic? If this person happened to have eaten walnuts and pecans last week, and let's say ate a whole bunch of them, and they were fine, and this week they just had a salad with a smattering of nuts and of similar nuts, then I would say no. So we need more of a history here.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Today we're talking to New York allergist Dr. Gary Stadtmauer. So what other kind of substances can people be allergic to beyond just food?
Medications, insects, you know, in terms of the type 4 or contact sensitivity, contact dermatitis that we discussed, the delayed hypersensitivity, those may be proteins, but also chemicals. So you're not likely to have anaphylaxis from a chemical, but you certainly can have a contact sensitivity to things like formaldehyde. People are probably most familiar with poison ivy, as I mentioned. And then, of course, there are common jewelry allergies. Nickel allergy, for example, is one of the most common sensitizers.
Well, I can say that we have received, I don't know whether I should use the phrase amazing or ridiculous amount of emails about being allergic to very specific things. I have a question here from Nightfall, and this person says, can you be allergic to lettuce? The reason my friend gives me for why you cannot be allergic to lettuce doesn't make sense to me.
It's not very common, but yes, you can be allergic to lettuce. Why not?
Well, is there anything that it's just impossible to be allergic to?
Is there a food that it's impossible to be allergic to? I would say probably the answer is, you could probably say sugar. Anything that is of such a low molecular weight that the immune system is just not programmed to recognize it, you cannot be allergic to. So sugar, for one thing, glucose is present throughout our body. Our cells depend upon glucose. So there's no way you can have an allergic response to glucose. Now, that's not to say that eating sugar can't make people feel sick. I
right.
have that all the time. I mean, sure, if you carb load, then you may get a surge of insulin and then you may crash afterwards, but that's not an allergy.
Well, we have a question from Austin. I saw in the news that they're finding people who are allergic to Wi-Fi and other electrical signals. It doesn't seem like that would be possible. Have you seen cases like this?
Oh, boy. No comment. I mean, that's really out there. I mean, electrical signals, I mean, that's a hotly debated topic, but allergic? You have to have some sort of contact with something to be allergic to it. I mean, are you really touched by Wi-Fi? I suppose in a sort of vague, ethereal, radiographic way. My short answer to that is it's impossible.
Well, let's look at it from the perspective that, for example, you can be allergic to things that you inhale, yes?
Correct.
So this would not fall into that category?
I don't believe so.
Okay. One assumes, but one should always question. Here's another one. Listeners, I love you guys. I have never heard of any of these things. We received a news article from a listener that wanted to remain anonymous. It's an article about a strange syndrome in which a man is allergic to their own semen. So, is that a thing?
It's a thing I've never heard of. But I did look it up before. There's almost nothing in the medical literature about this. The symptoms described seem very vague. They seem to last for a week and involve foggy brain as well as other things. Semen allergy does occur, but it occurs in women. And women can certainly have an allergic, even life-threatening reaction to semen because, after all, it's not a protein that is native to them. It's
right.
A foreign protein. And while it's rare, it's a serious problem. And the way it's managed, believe it or not, is with intravaginal hyposensitization, desensitization, in fact. What someone does is you actually have to bring the couple into the office, and one actually has to slowly administer semen intravaginally, and the woman gradually adapts to it, and then the prescription is for sex a few times a week to maintain the desensitization. Otherwise, it's lost. So that's a real phenomenon. Now,
that's a hard one right there.
That's a tough one, and it's fortunately not that common.
Well, how often does something like that happen, where somebody is allergic to their partner's, not necessarily semen, but other bodily fluids? And then how often does it happen that you are allergic to your own?
I don't think you can really be allergic to your own fluids. There are rare instances in which women do have something called autoimmune reactions to progesterone. Women can have a true allergy to their own hormones. Progesterone is one of the most common ones described. There's progesterone dermatitis that can occur. But in general, autoimmune diseases are a different condition other than which involve a different arm of the immune system rather than an allergy. It's really very unusual to have an allergic reaction to a part of yourself. I'd say it's almost impossible. One of the things to think about, though, is that because of hormonal shifts, mostly in women, the allergic arm of the immune system can be revved up. That can happen in pregnancy. That can happen during the menstrual cycle. A lot of women have a flare of asthma right before their period. And that's not allergic in the classic sense. They're not allergic to their hormones, but the hormones drive the allergic response because some of the allergic cells, in fact, have receptors and are stimulated. Receptors, let's say, for progesterone at progesterone and are stimulated to produce the allergen, to produce the compounds that lead to an allergic response.
This is a fascinating field you work in.
You said that last time. Thank you.
We have another listener question. I'm an organic gardener and mother who is very concerned with the growing number of genetically modified foods being sold in grocery stores. Is it true that genetically modified foods increase the risk of developing food allergies?
That really depends on how the foods are genetically modified. There was an example about 15 years ago. They were trying to make a nut, trying to substitute one nut protein for another, and I forget exactly the details, but what they did is they were taking the Brazil nut protein and they were putting it into something else. And what they found is that if you substitute the protein from one nut in another, then that allergy can also be transferred. So I think that whoever is involved in the genetically modified foods is they are at least, I think the companies and the researchers are cognizant of allergic potential. They did a proof of point study with Brazil nut, and the allergic potential of these foods, I think, is probably being explored before they're brought to market. Beyond that, I think I can't really say.
Technically, this is definitely something that is a legitimate concern then.
I think it's overall not. I think that the potential is there for it to be a problem, but it really depends how a food is genetically modified. I mean, if you're going to, you could cause trouble. Let's say if you transplanted the gene that produces the major allergen in peanuts into other foods, then of course you could create problems. But who would do that? Who would transplant the peanut allergen protein genes into, let's say, potatoes, tomatoes, and various other foods? It would just generate more problems. So are genetically modified foods going to be more allergenic? Are you going to produce genetically modified lettuce that will become more allergenic? That really would depend upon how they're modifying the genes. What genes are being modified? I can pretty much guarantee you that they're exploring the allergic side of things. But I, as an allergist, I have not been seeing much about this at the allergy conferences. It's really not it's not discussed because I think it's really just not an issue right now.
And another question from Barbara S. What does Dr. Stadtmauer think of multiple chemical sensitivity syndrome? Could it be an allergy?
I don't think much of multiple chemical sensitivity syndrome, and frankly, I'm not a big believer in it at all. I think there are a few people who are sensitized to chemicals, but if you are sensitized to chemicals, that will show up on what is called patch testing. I think that there are people who I have encountered who believe they have sensitivities to multiple things in their environment, and what they really have is a condition called vasomotor or non-allergic rhinitis. These are people who will sneeze or have a runny nose with a variety of irritants, perfumes, bleaches, etc., with a lower threshold for reacting than the average person. And that's not an allergy. They're not allergic to these things. They're simply sensitive to the volatile organic chemicals. But, you know, I think the big issue about this multiple chemical sensitivity syndrome is to what degree people are disabled by it. Are they not able to function socially? Do they try to go on disability as a result of this? I think there are simpler explanations for a lot of these things.
Well, you mentioned testing. So what are some of the ways that doctors do test for allergies?
There are skin tests for the immediate sensitivity reaction involving IgE that I discussed earlier. Mm-hmm. There is a serum test for allergic antibodies. And then there are patch tests for people suspected of having a contact dermatitis or delayed hypersensitivity. But I will say this about allergy testing in general. We don't shoot from the hip with these things. The way it works is that we take a history first. A proper diagnosis is made first by an experienced clinician listening to the patient and then testing appropriately, not the other way around. So when people come in and say, I want to be tested for foods, the question is not, okay, what's your insurance? Sure, come on in. It's well, why do you want to be tested? Well, if you have headaches and bloating after you eat dairy and wheat, my testing is not going to help you.
You mentioned false positives earlier. So there's that issue, but also testing wouldn't necessarily tell you what the symptoms would be that you could anticipate or the severity, correct?
Correct. I mean, I saw a patient today who has asthma and needed testing for routine respiratory allergens, and he had a strong reaction to cat. And he said, well, I play with cats all the time. I play with my friend's cat. How's that possible? I said, well, this test only shows that you have sensitization, but sensitization does not always equal symptoms. So it means that you probably are at higher risk at some point of developing symptoms, but not everybody with a positive skin test reacts.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm Desiree Schell. I'm talking to Dr. Gary Stettmauer, who teaches in the Allergy Fellowship Program at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine and has a private practice in Manhattan. So let's keep talking about the symptoms. What are the range? Because it does vary pretty widely.
The range of allergic responses depends on the conditions that we're discussing. Every allergic response has a range of symptoms from mild to severe. The mildest respiratory allergies can just involve itchy eyes and runny nose at the height of pollen season, or someone could have severe asthma, which is dependent upon daily medications, and that may be driven by allergy to some degree.
Do different types of allergies tend to cause different, I guess, clusters of symptoms?
Well, there are different types of food allergy. For example, food allergy may be local or systemic. That is, someone may purely have the oral allergy symptoms, as I described, mm-hmm. or they may ingest a food and have no symptoms in the mouth, but then go into shock after just a small amount of food allergen. For respiratory allergies, characteristic symptoms are sneezing, itching, runny nose for nasal congestion, perhaps some sinus discomfort with respiratory exposure. Lower airway symptoms, coughing and wheezing are usually indicative of asthma. And then there are people who have reactions to stinging insects, and that can vary from a normal local reaction with mild itching to what is called a large local reaction, and large local reactions are still not thought to be a major risk unto the most severe reaction to a stinging insect, which can be life-threatening, including wheezing, shortness of breath. Frankly, any reaction distant from the sting site in a stinging insect, so if somebody is stung on the arm but they have a few hives on the chest,
right,
that is considered anaphylaxis. It's a mild form, but it really is anaphylaxis, and that person needs evaluation.
So there's no real way to look at the symptoms and figure out what you're allergic to then, or if it's an allergy.
You know, the symptoms are often suggestive, and I would say that the symptoms are a guide, but the reason we test is that there is a great deal of overlap between, let's say somebody has sneezing every time they visit a friend, and they think it's the cat, but they don't know. It could be mold. It could be dust mite. It may not be an allergen at all. That's why we test. If the history was definitive, we wouldn't need to test.
So we have a question from Rob Tarr. Is there any evidence of a genetic component to allergies? In other words, are the children of allergic parents more likely to have those same allergies or any allergies than children of non-allergic parents?
That's a great question. The statistics are that an allergic father has a 30% chance of passing the allergic genes onto their child. An allergic mother has a 40% chance, and that probably has to do with the uterine environment as well. And if both parents are allergic, then the risk is about 70%. There is a tendency towards certain allergic manifestations to be inherited. So if someone is someone has severe eczema, their child may have eczema as well. But the allergy genes may be manifested in different ways. Two allergic parents could have, let's say, three allergic children. One of them with eczema, one of them with food allergies, and one of them with asthma.
Interesting. So is there a genetic test then for allergies?
There's no one genetic test for allergy. There are multiple genes that have been linked to allergy and asthma, but it's not one gene. Hmm. It's not like cystic fibrosis,
right,
or Tay-Sachs or another genetic disorder, which is due to a simple substitution of a nucleic acid.
Let's do another question from Rob Tarr. There's a common belief that early exposure to peanuts and peanut products can cause a peanut allergy to develop. Is there any science behind that belief?
That is a very hotly debated topic. I think most people know that food allergies are on the rise, and there are a lot of theories about that. And one of the theories about peanut is that exposure is driving this. And so first there were some advisories in the UK that peanut allergen be avoided in the first few years of life and during pregnancy. And a study was conducted where they compared genetically similar groups in Israel and the UK. And these were Ashkenazi Jewish children who in Israel tended to eat a snack called bamba, which is a peanut snack, at a very early age. They were given it pretty much as soon as they could eat. And they compared those children to the Ashkenazi children, and they found that the Ashkenazi children in the UK, that is, and they found that these children in the UK who tended to avoid peanut, in fact, had a higher incidence of food allergy.
Hmm.
So one study suggested that eating peanuts, peanut avoidance, was actually a bad thing. And then another study came out very recently from Mount Sinai, and they looked at risk factors during pregnancy, and they found that they looked at children who already had egg and milk allergy. And of those children, they found that mothers who had eaten peanuts during their pregnancy had a trend towards having peanut allergic children. And so what are we saying now? Are we saying that mothers should avoid peanuts and then kids should eat them from a very early age? I think we really don't know. I mean, I think we really just don't know the answer to this question yet. And I think that's because there are subgroups that are at higher risk than others. And it's an excellent question. And I would say the answer is that the jury is out.
We have a question from Swoopy, who is the host of the wonderful podcast Skepticality. Please explain the correlation, if any, between being breastfed and increased allergies.
That's another good question. And it does seem that breastfeeding in the first 4 to 6 months of life is protective for allergy. As to why that is, probably has to do with various antibodies that are passed through breast milk as well. It's definitely a recommendation these days that most children be breastfed the first 4 to 6 months.
And a question from Paula Unger. What makes an allergy develop late in life? I'm 67. I've always had seasonal hay fever, annoying but not life-threatening. But about 7 years ago, I developed an allergy to ibuprofen. Hives, swollen tongue, kind of scary. Might that result from a year on Vioxx?
I don't think it was the Vioxx, but if you go back about a half hour to the point where I was talking about aspirin allergy, that was an example where I mentioned that's an allergy that does not involve allergic antibodies. That's an allergy that triggers allergic cells directly, and it's not a classic allergy. Having said that, medication allergies are different than respiratory and food allergies. Medication allergies can really develop at any stage of life. A few risk factors exist for developing drug allergies. One of them is having multiple antibiotics, especially intravenous antibiotics. Another is having a number of underlying conditions, let's say liver disease, kidney disease. Certainly at any age, one can become allergic to medications. It's not the same as developing allergies to food or respiratory allergens.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back with more on allergies with Dr. Gary Stadtmauer after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, it's a pre-recorded interview with researcher and blogger Ash Donaldson to discuss the fascinating field of human factors engineering. This multidisciplinary science draws on anatomy, physiology, physics, psychology, and communications research as it tries to improve the ways that humans interact with technology and use technology to interact with each other. And health science journalist Paul Ingram returns with a primer on the causes and treatments of repetitive stress injuries. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time, live at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and today we're revisiting what turned out to be a very popular topic, allergies. I'm speaking to allergist Dr. Gary Stadtmauer, who teaches in the Allergy Fellowship Program at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine and maintains a private practice in Manhattan. We've talked about a lot of symptoms and ways to find out if you have allergies, but how about getting rid of them? I have a question from Alex Ross. Does eating honeycomb from your local area build up a tolerance to the pollen and such that creates havoc for some people's allergies?
Is there enough pollen in the honeycomb to desensitize someone? That's the first question. Can you desensitize somebody orally is the next question, I suppose. What's in the honeycomb? There may be pollen grains. And so can eating pollen grains reduce your sensitivity? This is an active area of research, and it's called sublingual immunotherapy or oral immunotherapy, and it's just like allergy shots, and it's given with small but increasing doses. But you really have to eat quite a lot of it. There has to be a large enough dose to induce a different immune response. So I would say that even if theoretically there were some pollen in the honeycomb, it would probably not be enough to induce a immunity. And in fact, because you really never know how much pollen is in there, if anything, it could even induce an allergic reaction.
So what are the successful forms of treatment then?
Well, there are three for respiratory allergy. There's medication, there's of course avoidance, and then there are allergy shots and or immunotherapy. And as I mentioned, you know, one form is the oral form, and that's still in the U.S. investigational, though probably in a few years there will be FDA-approved treatments. And then the traditional treatment is what people are most familiar with, and these are allergy shots, and the actual complete allergen is administered an injection under the skin, and it's done in a slow and increasing amount because the actual allergen, the complete protein, is present as opposed to a vaccine, which protects you but doesn't make you sick and therefore can be given in a full dose. The allergy shots are given slowly, starting at a very low dose because it's the complete allergen that can make you sick. And the response rate is really very good for people who have pollen allergies, hay fever. I would say the response rate is about 85%. But a lot of the medications, especially the stronger ones, the nasal steroid sprays, are so good these days that really only the more severe hay fever sufferers wind up on allergy shots.
Well, what about the idea of growing out of an allergy? Is anyone looking at whether we can figure out a way to force that to happen or to hurry it up?
Well, there are certainly food allergies can be outgrown. And as to speeding it up, I think that's a good question. I mean, what we don't know, for instance, there are investigations with kids who are so exquisitely allergic to peanut that what they are doing is peanut desensitization. What they are literally giving children, only, by the way, under very, very close medical supervision, they are actually giving them very tiny amounts of peanut and then slowly desensitizing them to peanut. What's not clear is what happens to these kids long term. Once they've been on peanut for a while, do you induce long term immunity? If they stop eating peanut, are they at the same risk that they were at, let's say, a few years before they were exposed to the peanut desensitization protocol? I don't know that we have those answers yet. But changing immunity usually involves something like allergy shots, because that's one thing that actually converts your immune response from a more allergic to a less allergic response. So generally, the way to modify the immune system is either with some sort of exposure to the allergen shifting the immune response, or else some sort of aggressive immune modulating therapy, which probably is not warranted.
From my quick Google searching, it looks like there's quite a bit of pseudoscience still around the idea of allergies and their treatments. So I Googled natural allergy remedy, and maybe we could just go over a few of the most popular that popped up.
Sure.
Neti pots.
That's fine. A neti pot goes back to India. It's a remedy that's a few thousand years old, and it's a simple irrigation of the nose with warm water. Some people add salt and bicarbonate. There are forms of there are recipes online that people could look up if they're interested, or they can buy packets or even pre-mixed solutions. And those help with sinus symptoms. We advise irrigation. I actually advise irrigation for a lot of my chronic sinus patients. I would say just about all of them. And it can reduce symptoms of nasal allergies. After all, if you have pollen grains in the nose that you've breathed in during the pollen season and you come in from outdoors and you have allergic mucus in your nose, which is stimulating further responses, what better way to treat it than just to flush it all out?
Brilliant. So this is actually an effective course of action then?
It is.
Are there any side effects at all?
Well, I think some people just don't like doing it. I mean, I think it takes used to, you know, it's not a spray. You're actually pouring about 4 ounces of liquid into your nose. It has to come out somewhere, and the where it comes out is the other nostril. And if you're not doing it correctly, then it can even go into the back of your throat, and people feel as if they're choking. But what I tell my patients is that if they tilt their head to one side and they say the letter K, just say K, 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 what that does is that elevates the palate and prevents the fluid from dripping into the back of the throat.
So we have something called quercetin. It's supposedly a natural plant-derived compound called a bioflavonoid, and it helps stabilize mast cells and prevents them from releasing histamine.
There are very, very few articles in the medical literature describing the herbal antihistamine properties. Quercetin has one going back to 1963. And what I usually tell my patients is that the prescription antihistamines, such as cetirizine, are very inexpensive and once a day, and they are generally more effective and less costly than the herbal remedies. And the fact is that you know, a drug like cetirizine has been around in various forms for 50 years. We prescribe it to the elderly, to pregnant women. It's a pregnancy category B medication. It's given to infants. And I have probably prescribed a drug like cetirizine, 10 to 20,000 times, if not more. And I can tell you that in my 15 years of practice as an attending allergist, I have seen one case of a drug allergy to cetirizine, and it's extremely rare. And I really, you know, other than some fatigue, the over-the-counter antihistamines are extremely well tolerated, and well, that's really the way to go, not herbs.
Well, are there any really odd natural or not really remedies, herbal or otherwise, that you see on a regular basis when people are trying to self-medicate?
You know, I think that when people go for chiropractic treatments for asthma or massage therapy or reflexology or other sort of body manipulation treatments, these are just things that are not going to work for an allergic reaction. Now, if someone has a sinus headache, then acupuncture may be helpful, but it's a temporary salve at best.
Could you give us a few credible online resources for people that do have questions about allergies? Because there's a lot out there that is not credible from my brief analysis.
Right. Well, a great resource is the Allergy and Asthma Foundation of America. That's the AAFA. I think it's AAFA.org. And another resource would be the website of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. That's AAAAI.org. And I would say that if you stick to major references, preferably by a society that, you know, if you have a heart condition, you're going to go to the American Heart Association, for example. If you have asthma, you could go to the American Lung Association. These are also good references.
Thanks very much for being on the show again, Dr. Stadtmauer.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it.
You can re-listen to or download this episode at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to our past episodes to Facebook and Twitter, or to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna...
gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells, cause we're skeptically speaking, our mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks, all the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, who I don't think you understand, it's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless, let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore, just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on, the skeptics await your letter,